Napa know-how.
A Napa guy knows more isn't always better, unless we're talking about full-size vans. These beasts do more than get you from A to B. They have so much space a man can live in it. With shag carpeting, waterbed, and a sweet lava lamp, these mobile abodes have all the comforts of home. With quality parts and plenty of Napa know-how, you can keep the original tiny house running longer, stronger. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how.
Danny, I just figured out that if I switch to Metro PCS, I get two Samsung Galaxy phones free.
Cool, Dad.
And I could be a super dad with two free Samsung Galaxy phones and call myself Double Galaxy Man.
Or you could give the second phone to your sidekick.
Yeah, I guess I could do that.
That's right. Two free Samsung Galaxy On 5 smartphones are all yours when you switch to Metro PCS. Metro PCS. Wireless. Figured out.
Coverage not available in some areas. Sales tax not included in phone price. Excludes numbers on the T-Mobile network. See store for details and terms and conditions.
Blog Talk Radio.
Je vous écoute. Je vous écoute.
Live, several miles from Hollywood. It's Advice Goddess Radio. With nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcorn. You tell me. You call home. Should call home fast.
Hi, welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. Now, I have two sisters, but I'm 5 years older than the younger one, and we really didn't spend much, if any, time together when we were growing up. We've grown close later in life, and now we'll be on the phone together with Greg, my boyfriend. It about explodes his brain, how alike we laugh and talk, and we even find ourselves thinking the same thoughts. So although we're not twins and didn't grow up in different households like some of the twins Dr. Nancy Siegel studies, we are constantly amazed to find out how alike we are and how wildly different we both seem from the sister between us. Experiencing this brings up questions of nature versus nurture. How much of us is shaped by environment and how much by our genes? Questions that actually are perhaps best answered by research on twins. And with that, I will introduce you to my guest tonight, developmental psychologist and Cal State Fullerton professor Dr. Nancy Siegel, who is herself a twin and has specialized in researching twins. Tonight, she will talk about some of her most fascinating findings and delve into what it is that makes us the people we are and how much it's possible to change the course of, let's say, environmental and genetic history. Hello, Nancy.
Hello, Amy. How are you?
Great. I'm so glad to have you on. You are actually one of the three most fascinating people I try to sit next to always at a dinner party, and one of them is Steven Pinker, so you're in good company. So I'm really thrilled to have you on. And I wanted to start out by asking you a little bit about your own personal background, starting with being a twin. So you're a twin, but actually you and your sister, people don't mistake you for twins.
People would never mistake us for twins, Amy. My twin sister and I are fraternal twins, which means that we share only half our genes on average, which is exactly the same as ordinary siblings, but we happen to be born at the same time. We look very different. Anne is 4 inches taller than I am. Seems like 6 sometimes. And she's got very curly hair and just a different body build than me. We're just very, very different. And I think it was those differences that really propelled me towards twin research, because as a child, I used to think, how is it possible for two children to be born into the same family at exactly the same time and end up being so different? So when I got to college and began to study genetics and developmental psychology, I realized that she and I just came into the world with different sets of genetic factors, and it was those genes that kind of took us in very, very different directions. And because I'm a twin, I relate very well to other twins, and so studying twins for me has been a wonderful personal experience as well as a professional one, because using twins in research tells us so much about who we are, how we got that way, and where we may be going.
So tell us about your research path. You were actually involved in the Minnesota Twin Survey, which is very famous, and then you went out on your own, and you've been doing some very fascinating research since then.
That's right. I was a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Minnesota for 9 years, where I worked on the world-famous study of twins raised apart. And these are twins who were raised in separate homes, many times not even knowing they were a twin. and they would then meet as adults either by accident because of mistaken identity or by doing a search for biological families. So they would meet in adulthood, and often there would be some notoriety among the reunion through TV or a newspaper, and this is how we located the twins. And by the time the study ended in 1999, we had seen 137 reared apart twins. About 81 of them were identical twins, meaning they had all their genes in common, and the other 56 were fraternal twins, like my sister and me. And we found that across a very broad range of behaviors and physical characteristics and medical conditions, there is genetic influence. The genes don't explain everything, but the identical twins were much more alike than the fraternals. And why this information is so important is that it tells us about all of us. If we have a certain condition, or we have a certain habit, or we have a certain personality, it's not by accident we're that way. Part of it is probably due to our genetic inheritance.
You know, I just got a new puppy, and I went to these breeders, and they show how they bred parents. They test them to see if they're carriers of certain diseases. And I wanted to know, how soon will it be before we do this? You know, the way they did this, by the way, is they made sure if one was a carrier for something, they bred it with one who wasn't a carrier. How soon before we do this as humans? We test for Tay-Sachs, but where we test more broadly for all sorts of diseases to see if parents are going to give birth to perhaps very sick children.
Right. Well, as you say, Tay-Sachs is a fairly routine procedure now, and there are other genetic diseases that are tested for. Mothers go through a whole series of things that you can actually test right now from the blood, and of course, older mothers need to know if a child they're carrying could potentially be a Down syndrome child, but that, of course, is after the child is already conceived. But there are many, many things that we can test for. There are, however, things that we cannot test for, and so even getting a clean bill of health from the laboratory does not ensure the birth of a healthy child. And, of course, other things sometimes can go wrong. I've always been amazed at how things often go right, given the number of things that can go wrong. So I think, and if you think about twins, these are very, very precarious, difficult pregnancies, at least they can be, because females are designed to really carry only one baby. So when you have two babies, they're usually born early, and that's always a marker for some kind of stress, increased risk of cerebral palsy or increased risk of other things, low birth weight babies, a whole range of things. So twin births are really a rare kind of thing. They've been going up, of course, because of in vitro fertilization, but nevertheless, twin births are still relatively rare in the population.
Well, what do you think of these mothers who take these fertility drugs? You know, they have these multiple births, not just twins, you know, and sometimes there was that octomom who intended to, but sometimes it's an accident. What's your take on this?
Well, I think that it's perfectly fine to take fertility drugs. After all, this is a marvelous medical intervention that's allowed infertile couples to have pregnancies they normally wouldn't be able to have. But now we're at the point where we can very successfully implant one embryo, or maybe two at the most, and so we can have very healthy, successful pregnancies this way. The days of implanting 4, 5, and 6, those days are really over. And while there were no rules in the United States about this, there really are some very firm guidelines. Quite frankly, Amy, I'm rather happy about in vitro fertilization, and the reason is that it has been a very dramatic rise in the twinning rate. The twinning rate in 1980 was 1 in 60 babies, and now the twinning rate is 1 in 30 babies, largely
wow.
because of in vitro fertilization and because mothers are delaying the childbearing years. And we know that when mothers do delay the childbearing years, this increases the chance of fraternal twinning. So for someone like me, I'm actually pleased about it because it means more twins for me to study.
Right. I want to talk about this book that you wrote that I just loved. It's called Someone Else's Twin, The True Story of Babies Switched at Birth. And for anyone just tuning in, I should say, I'm talking with twins researcher and developmental psychologist Dr. Nancy Siegel. And this book, Someone Else's Twin, and her three other books can be found on her website, drnancysiegeltwins.org, and that's S-E-G-A-L. So Someone Else's Twin is the book if you want to look it up on Amazon. So tell us the story. So you basically dropped everything to fly to the Canary Islands to study these two twins who were switched
yes,
at birth.
I did. It was amazing, Amy. There were three babies born in the Canary Islands probably now 40 years ago, a pair of identical twin girls, Begonia and Beatrice, and then another baby who was born a few days later. Because it was very crowded in the nursery, all three babies were placed in the same incubator. A nurse came to bring one of the twins to a different medical procedure, and when she brought her back, she put her in the wrong place. This caused the single twin, who now took the name Delia, to be raised by the family of the single child, and it caused a fake fraternal twin pair to go home with the mother of the twins. So you had this false fraternal twin pair, Begonia and Beatrice, and this twin who was raised alone named Delia. Now, what's fascinating about this is that the mothers thought that their children looked a little different than the rest of the family, but they thought, well, probably some genes on my husband's side, always quick to blame the husbands. Anyway, everybody led their lives till the twins were 28, and then Begonia was out at a shopping mall, and she ran into a sales clerk in a shop who insisted on calling her Delia, and when she said she wasn't Delia, the shop clerk was quite miffed. But Begonia went back a few days later to return the T-shirt, and this time the shopping clerk said, you've got to stay here, and I'm going to get your phone number and all this. And she arranged a meeting that night, and it was clear who the twins were. So it was a switch, and this is rather rare. I looked up switched at birth twins, and I've only found 6 or 7 pairs in the world that are recorded. Now, these got together because they were identical and they were confused, but you've got to imagine that fraternal twins who were switched are not going to find each other as easily because they look so different. Now, earlier, Amy, you mentioned the Minnesota study of twins reared apart that I was involved with for 9 years in Minnesota. And out of the 137 pairs of twins we had in that project, there was one case of switched at birth twins there from Canada. And that was another amazing case. All three boys, the twins and the single boy, were placed in temporary foster care. The single boy was supposed to be adopted, but when the elderly couple caring for all three couldn't handle three babies, they decided to move the twins. But they mistakenly moved one twin and a single baby. Oh, so again, this decoupled the twins, and they didn't meet again until they were 20. They met because they both were fascinated in odd games, odd movies, anything kind of odd, at the University of Ottawa in Canada. And it was their interest in these things that actually brought them together. And the amazing thing, too, was they were best friends for about a year until they realized maybe we're twins. And, of course, it led to a lawsuit against the Ottawa Children's Society and all kinds of things. And they came to Minnesota, and they were much more alike. The identical twins were much more alike than either one was to the single child. And what is fascinating is that you've got identical genes in different environments, and you've got unrelated people raised together believing they're fraternal twins, and they're much less alike. So, really, we as humans cannot organize different matings or rearings among people, but you can take advantage of these odd kinships that just happen naturally. And that's something that I just love. And we can talk more about these odd kinships and odd relationships. I just love them. They're so scientifically interesting.
Oh, they're fascinating. And you've done new work on people who actually look alike, which we'll get into. But I wanted to ask you more about this story. This actually didn't work out so well for these two girls or for all the people involved. Some of them
were
better.
That's right. It really didn't. I would say, first of all, it was devastating to the families, to the parents who had wanted these children and then realized that all their lives they've been raising babies who did not belong to them. So that was devastating, even though they still love the child they raised, but it was not their child. And what it does is it totally revamps your sense of identity, who you are. I mean, can you imagine all you viewers out there waking up one morning to find out that everything you thought was true about yourself was not. Your parents weren't your parents. Your siblings weren't your siblings. In short, you were totally somebody else and should have had a different life. So what happened was that the two twins realized that they should have been together all their lives, and Delia, the one who was raised in the wrong family by herself, had developed leukemia when she was 16. Little did she know that across the Canary Islands, there was a perfect bone marrow donor for her. Instead, she had to undergo the more risky auto transplant. And the one who may have suffered, I don't want to say the most, but in a certainly unique way, was Beatrice, the unrelated girl raised as Begonia's twin, because suddenly she's not a member of the family. She feared that they would lose the love for her. She feared that her sister Begonia would prefer the twin and not her. And she never really got along with her biological parents, who wanted to almost treat her like a child and not like, a 28-year-old girl. So it was really difficult for everybody involved. All the parents were on tranquilizers. They were seeing therapists. I mean, and they were hounded by the press. It was just a very, very difficult situation for all of them.
God, this is so terrible. And so fathers used to be the only ones who worried that a child wasn't theirs. But you say in someone else's twin that this is so chilling, that there are about 20,000 accidental baby switches in hospitals in the U.S., but that most of these are corrected before the parents go home.
Yes, but see, given that statistic, and by the way, that's been replicated by an independent agency, given that many that occur that we know have been corrected, you have to imagine that some happen that are not corrected. And so for every mistake, it means the two parents are going home with the wrong child. And so, as you say, paternity uncertainty, worries of fathers that babies aren't theirs because, after all, fertilization is internal, women are receptive all the time. So fathers always have to worry. Mothers really never did because along human history, women gave birth at home, surrounded by friends, family, and that sort of thing. I don't think that mothers today worry. I don't think so because it's not really part of the human female behavioral repertoire. But I think that as news of such cases get out, I think that women may start. After all, remember the mother of Begonia and Beatrice. She noticed that one of the children was a little bit darker in skin tone than her family, but she didn't think it was the wrong baby. She thought it was her husband's fault. And the mother raising the single twin thought that Delia looked a little bit lighter than her family, but again, she blamed that on her husband too. So the idea that it was not their baby did not immediately occur to them. But I think that for any family having a baby in a hospital, and this is the majority of women, I think one thing you want to do is always make sure that your baby is yours. You want to make sure that the ID number matches the ankle bracelet and your wristband. When the nurse comes in bringing the baby, you want to double check it. There are lots of little things people can do that will empower you as a patient, and I think it's important to do that. Most mothers who deliver babies in hospitals don't really think that a baby is not theirs, and I think that's because it's not part of the human female behavioral repertoire to think about that. But I think that if news gets out about these switched at birth cases or hospital mistakes, I think mothers going in for deliveries will be more vigilant about that and will pay greater attention to matching their ID number to the babies. So that's just a bit of advice.
Is that the answer? How do people prevent this, you know, getting their babies switched?
Well, I think that, as I said, you've got to be vigilant to make sure that everything matches. But I spoke to an expert on this when I was in Spain, in Madrid, and he claims that the best thing to do is to have fingerprints taken. There's ways of doing it for a newborn baby, and it wouldn't hurt the baby at all. So you get fingerprints from the mother and the child at the delivery and then again at the discharge. And it's a simple procedure. It's non-invasive. That would be the ideal thing from my perspective.
Yeah, that seems like the least costly thing and very important to do. And people, even if you're not a fingerprints expert, you could blow up Xerox the fingerprint, blow it up and compare it and be a little CSI about it.
Absolutely. And actually, people sometimes think that footprints are good, but baby footprints are not. They tend to change. So you really have to use the fingerprints.
Wow, that's very interesting. And just about this Beatrice Begonia and Delia case, mothers think they know their children and, you know, this really calls that into question, or, you know, maybe it's human cognitive biases at work that we believe what we want to believe. And these people, it isn't like they went home with one Spanish-looking kid and a light-skinned redhead. You know, if you're in the Canary Islands, probably you look like a lot of other people in the Canary Islands.
Well, yes, and the Canary Islands is a very, very mixed population, and so there's been a lot of mixture. And so, you know, babies just sometimes genes that are in your family for a couple of years don't come out, you know, for a while, and yet it's perfectly your child. But I think that, you know, women believe that when you're handed a baby, it's your baby. There's no reason to think otherwise. There have been a lot of experimental studies done where they'll have a mother exposed to a newborn for a short time, and then they'll bring the mom three babies and say, sniff the baby and pick yours out, or touch the baby's hand and pick out which is yours. And mothers are pretty good at this because new mothers are pretty hormonally exquisitely sensitive to their babies. But my question always has been, if you just give a mother a single baby, how does she know it's hers? And I think in cases like that, a mom could be mistaken. You know, there has been a slight increase in home deliveries, and at first I thought maybe it's because mothers were afraid of hospital switches, but most mothers don't say that. They say they simply want a more intimate experience at home. So that's the reason. Now, getting back to the three women, Begonia, Delia, and Beatrice, I actually was lucky enough to be able to go back there to the Canary Islands last November in 2012. And it was wonderful to see them all together again. They've really all come to understand their situation, to accept it, and to really be friends with one another. You know, Begonia and Delia could be closer as twins, but I think that Begonia is just afraid to do that because she doesn't want to hurt Beatrice's feelings, Beatrice being the unrelated girl she grew up with. But they all have sort of understood their fate. They accept it now. The mothers and fathers, I think, have been less able to move on. But the twins, being younger, perhaps understand that sometimes these things just happen.
And what about the salesperson who confused Begonia for Delia in the clothing store, which was the event that led to their reunion, discovery of the switch? Have you found her or found out what she thinks of what happened?
No. Amy, I was desperate to find her, and I went back to the shop where she worked, and I found someone who knew her. And I tried to find her after that, but it was impossible. And my understanding is that she was trying to, according to one of the twins, she was trying to sort of cash in on this experience. But I've never found her, and yet I'm dying to know what she really thinks about this, because this is one thing that leads to such a dramatic change in people's lives. You know, some of the mothers said, we would have preferred it if this had never happened. We just would never have known. We would have been blissfully ignorant. On the other hand, you have to wonder, is that really true? Now, suppose Delia has a relapse in her leukemia. Well, she has a perfect donor in Begonia. So can you really say that the truth or information is not important? I don't know. I think it probably varies from experience to experience, from person to person. I'm on the outside. I can't really say. I can only imagine. I think I'd always want to have information, but I'm not those people. They're the ones whose lives were changed, and dramatically so. I should also point out, Amy, that Begonia, Beatrice, and Delia give us a marvelous scientific experiment because you've got, again, the genes in different places, but you've got unrelated people raised together that I call virtual twins. And we can talk about my virtual twin study, too. But it's a wonderful scientific experiment just because a nurse made a mistake and brought a baby to a wrong location.
Well, what is your feeling if somebody is in the position of this shop clerk? You know, if you know two people and you think, oh, my God, I think that they're twins separated at birth, that they look that much alike and seem that much alike, do you tell? You know, you're kind of playing God in a way.
You are kind of playing God, but it is information. And I think that you really need to tell people and they will deal with it. Imagine if you knew it and you never told them and they learned about it years later. That's the question. People, I think, need to know information, and then they can decide what they want to do with it. You're also playing God if you don't release that information. So, you know, again, I mean, do you ask the parents what they think, but then you're keeping it from the adult twins? I think that if they were children, yes, you tell the parents. Obviously, you know, a two-year-old, a three-year-old is not going to know, but you certainly tell the parents, and then it's up to them to decide what they want to do. Along these lines, I also write in the book Someone Else's Twin about an amazing family in Puerto Rico where two moms whose last names were the same, Hernandez, both delivered twins within a few days of each other, and the hospital switched one child in each pair. So each mother went home with their child and someone else's. And this went on for about a year and a half until the aunt of one of the twins was in a hospital waiting room and saw what she thought was her niece, but it wasn't her niece because she knew her niece was home. And that led to that reunion. And the kids were only two by the time. Now, when the mothers were smart, they had visiting arrangements for a while so the kids could get used to each other. And they switched them back when they were two. But I can tell you that it was shamefully, just horrendous for the parents who were madly in love with these children.
Yeah, and this is so sad.
And I was able to interview one of the twins who was switched back, and she has no recollection of being raised in any other situation. But for the parents, I was very fortunate because I was the first one they would speak to. And I think that, you know, my being a twin perhaps made a difference because they were tired of speaking just to the press, but they would speak to me as a twin and a researcher. And it was devastating for them, absolutely devastating, to relinquish a child that they had cared for 2 years. You can just imagine.
Oh,
and
wow.
I also want to just tell your reader, your listenership, too, that genes account for similarities and differences between people. And so I don't want people to suddenly think, oh, my God, my son doesn't look like me. Oh, my God, my daughter looks so different than my husband. Maybe they're not my children. Children can look extremely different from their parents, and siblings can look extremely different from each other. And these cases, these switches do occur rarely. So just because your child doesn't look different, please don't go out and get worried. There's really no reason.
I think that's a very good point. I'm talking with developmental psychologist and twins researcher Dr. Nancy Siegel. She's author of Someone Else's Twin, The True Story of Babies Switched at Birth, very compelling book. We've been talking about that. We're going to move on to some of her other work. And this book and her three other books can be found on her website, drnancysiegeltwins.org, and that's S-E-G-A-L, so you can find that right. So I wanted to ask you just one more question about this, which is, at what age, you had some sense of this, can kids be switched back when there's a swap at birth, an accidental swap at birth, without it damaging the kids? And, you know, I guess the families, the parents are already cognizant and they're going to be probably
right.
really hurt. But that the kids, you talked about this one child maybe at 2 years sort of not having
yeah.
any recollection.
Right. I would say that the maximum is probably about age 3, because kids don't have too much memory of people, places, or events prior to that. But after that, I think that it would be a very difficult thing for the children to be switched back, because they're so attached to their parents by then, familiar surroundings, that sort of thing. Now, I can tell you a very difficult story that I also write about in Someone Else's Twin, and this happened in Geneva, Switzerland, back in the 40s or 30s, and it was a small town called Fribourg, and they only had 12 baby beds there, and two moms gave birth very close in time, identical twins and a single boy. And the single boy and the twin got switched because there they just identified you not by electronic wristbands but by a little sign hung at the end of your bed. And so the mother took home what she thought were fraternal twins, and she loved them both, and the other mother took a single boy. She adored this child. And what happened was that the mother now of the single twin was from the German-speaking part of town. The other mother with the twins was from the French-speaking part of town. But the French-speaking parents wanted their children to also learn German. So when the kids were 5 or 6, she put them in a German-speaking school, and that's when all the three children got to know each other, and people said, oh, my God, these are the twins, but these other two boys look so much alike.
Wow.
Well, one thing led to another, and it was recognized that these two were probably the twins, and all three boys went to Geneva for extensive medical testing. Now, in those days, there was no DNA analysis done, but what they did was a fascinating example of biological identity. They took reciprocal skin transplants, and the skin transplants took between the twins, but they were rejected between the twins and the single boy.
Wow.
Now, the boys were 7 by then, and this was then turned over to the magistrate in the town, who decided they should be switched back. And you can imagine it was so difficult for the twins for the switched children, because they were now in a strange family. They didn't understand why they were being switched. They didn't speak the same language as the family. And they kept on thinking, maybe it's a vacation, I'm going home. And I was lucky enough to be able to speak to the one surviving member from this trio. And he's now in his 60s. He's still living in Geneva. The other two have passed away. I went to see him about 2 summers ago, and he said that he suffered tremendously too. Because you think, well, how could he suffer? He was in the right place. Well, he said that his parents had to put so much effort into making the other child comfortable that he was largely ignored, and he missed his twin brother, the one he'd grown up with.
Oh, that's so sad.
So everybody suffers in their wrong way. So you're asking about the age. If anyone discovers a switched child, I think 3 is the maximum. 7 was a mistake. And if you think about it, they all live in the same town. They could have had visitations, and when the boys were older, they might have made some decisions independently of the parents.
Wow, yeah, it really seems that would be much smarter to sort of be a collective rather than, here, we're going to hand you this child like a package. I just wanted to get into, you talk about how we're genetically influenced. You use that word, and I wanted to ask you, genes versus environment, where does the line lie? I know it's different per person, and you talk about some of the flaws in thinking of people who criticize twin research. So talk a little bit about that.
Okay. First, let's talk about genes and environment. And let me say that in a single person, genes and environments cannot be separated. They're completely intertwined. But when we say that
body height has a 95% genetic influence, or intelligence has a 70%, or personality a 50%. There we are estimating percentages based on populations. If I took a group of people and I measured their height, for example, there would be variation among them, some tall, some short, some medium. Why do people differ in height? Partly because of the genes and partly because of the environment. And so what I'm saying is that individual differences in a group, are the variation in that is about 80% genetic, 20% environmental. But if I take a single person, I can't split it apart into any kind of percentages. Now, if I find out that something like height has about a 90% genetic influence, which it does, that gives me some guidelines as to how much genes affect height. But a single child, it could be that his height is all environmentally influenced. Let's suppose the child was dropped on its head when it was a baby. His height will be severely stunted. So in that particular case, it would be a much greater environmental effect. Okay, so that's one thing. Now, the other thing is that I never like to use the word determining or deterministic in terms of the genes. I like the word influence because the environment will affect gene expression. If I'm somebody, say, that is allergic to penicillin, so that's a genetic effect. But if I never have penicillin, I'm never going to express the allergy. If someone I know has a predisposition to cardiac conditions, if this person has a good diet and good exercise and stress-free, then this person may never have a cardiac attack or maybe a minor one. So the environment can modify genetic expression. Now, having said that, we all know that it's good to read to children, to sing to children, to give children the best educational opportunities that we can provide. But the best education is not the same for each child. Some children love lots of rich educational experiences, and some kids would find it to be an overload, and they'd shy away from it. We can make everybody better, but we can't make everybody the same. Just like if you want to be a great athlete, well, it takes some genetic effect. You've got to have certain kinds of motivation and certain kinds of body build for certain kinds of sports. You can practice and practice till you're blue in the face and you may still never succeed, whereas somebody who has very little motivation may actually do quite well because they have the right body type. So really, we can think of the genes as setting these broad ranges and the environment kind of leading us towards certain areas within those ranges.
So an example of this, you reminded me, a friend of mine is friends with Michael Gilmore, who is one of the nonviolent siblings of serial killer Gary Gilmore. He's written a book about this, and he feels, if best as I can recall, that the stresses and the abuse, say neglectful, horrible parents, that these abuses during their childhood push Gary only over the edge. The other siblings weren't violent. So talk about this, where one kid ends up going really bad and the others don't, despite going through the same stressors, pretty much. Maybe that's not really true the same, but they're in a lot of the same.
Right. Well, it probably is a combination of the different genes, because after all, these are not identical twins. These are full siblings born a couple of years apart. And so it could be that this stressful environment was just mixing with the particular genetic background of the one person, leading to the serial killing or whatever, and in the other case, it simply was not. Or maybe the second child, who did not become the serial killer, could see what was happening to his brother and backed off. Sometimes what happens to one sibling can be kind of a warning sign for another one. I think another interesting example of this kind of thing, Amy, is if you look at identical twins who differ in some way, because if genes affect the behavior, you'd expect identical twins to be the same all the time, and they're not. In fact, even though identical twins are more alike than anybody else when it comes to any kind of trait, it's still not 100% similarity. So take something like schizophrenia. If you're an identical twin with schizophrenia, the chance that you're co-twin or your identical twin sibling would also have the condition is only about 40 or 50%. So why is that? It has to do with what we call epigenetics, the turning on or the turning off of certain genes. Some genes get expressed in one twin, but they don't get expressed in another. And why is that? This is one of the hottest areas in behavioral science and medical science research today. And it could be something prenatally, it could be something postnatally, we just really don't know. But it's a wonderful, wonderful design, because if we can figure out what that environmental trigger is that expresses the genes in one twin or silences them in the other, we can then use that information to help everybody else in the population who may be at risk for certain types of things.
Well, one thing that this calls to mind is how one of the twins in the Canary Islands, the separated at birth twins, had leukemia and the other did not. And that, you wonder, okay, what was her environment? Were there chemicals in her environment? Is this something else? Did they have slight variations even though they were identical?
Yeah, that's a terrific example, actually. And that's something that I have researched a little bit. And it turns out that for infantile leukemia, it's more likely the case that with identical twins, one is affected and one isn't. And this even gets expressed very, very early on. So you have to wonder, in that case, it's probably something prenatal, but what it is, we just don't know. Now, in the case of Begonia and Delia, where Delia did not develop the cancer until she was 16, maybe she did live near some chemicals. Now, I know that one thing that both twins did was that they were house cleaners. And it could be that exposure to these chemicals, you know, cleaning fluids, whatever, might have triggered some predisposition in Delia. Maybe Begonia had different chemicals or didn't do it as often, because I think that Begonia stopped doing house cleaning a little bit earlier than Delia did. But at any rate, these are the kinds of situations that potentially have so much information for how we can prevent or treat disease in non-twins.
So since we don't get a genetic printout, we're really in the infancy stages of that, is it possible at all to shift our environment to make the best of the genes we have?
Yes, it is. And you have to remember that all of us have a whole wide range of environments that we can gravitate towards. There are so many different occupations we could enter into, or people we could marry, or things that we could do with our lives. People have lots of interests, lots of talents. And so I think that the key is to figure out what you like the most and really try to put yourself in environments that really allow you to fully express what it is that makes you happy. One of my colleagues at the University of Minnesota, the late Dr. David Licken, was very interested in happiness. And he said that exactly this, that what you need to do is to figure out what makes you happy and then find those environments that really allow you to experience all that. And it works the other way too. If you know that there are certain things that stress you out, suppose that you're the kind of person that always has to know exactly what's happening. You have to have your appointments all set up. You have to know where you're meeting your friend. You have to know what you're going to order for dinner at the restaurant. Well, that can be awfully stressful for you, but at least if you recognize it, you can try to set up things so that at least you have most of your information in advance. So it's a matter of figuring out what makes you stressful and what makes you happy, and try to tailor your environments as best as you can. I know that some of my students here at Cal State Fullerton don't like to give oral reports. It makes them nervous, so they try to take classes where they're only writing papers. Or some people hate exams, so they take the classes with written papers. So it's a matter of figuring out what works for you.
And this is one of the very helpful things, I think, about your research, looking at environment versus genetics, that we realize, look, there are environments that are going to turn on or turn off genes and the expression of genes, and that are going to be better or worse for us. And if we're really conscious of that, you know, you can just not accept, okay, this is my environment, maybe seek to change it because it's going to be better for you, probably if you're more comfortable in an environment. You know, if you don't like loud noises and bustling stuff, don't live in a city if that's upsetting to you. And probably it's going to be better for you in bigger ways than just, you know, you're not bothered at night.
Exactly. And I think that another way this information is so helpful to parents raising children is that what works for one child does not necessarily work for the other child. And I always tell parents that fair treatment is not identical treatment. You don't have to treat your children exactly the same way. You don't have to provide exactly the same experiences for both, because it may make one child happy and one child uncomfortable. I know that my parents, and I can say this about parents of twins because they really try to be the fanatics of fairness. Parents of twins, particularly fraternal twins, really have to key into what makes each child happy. Now, I loved doing ballet lessons, so I got ballet lessons as a child. My sister hated ballet, so she took drama lessons. And those are very different types of experiences that we had. But my parents were fair in that respect because they really tried to tailor the opportunities to match the interests and talents of each one of us. So I think that parents should not feel guilty if they're not providing exactly the same thing to each child, because it's not going to make each child happy. You've got to give each child what they want.
That is such a great point, and I see it with my neighbor's kids. They are all so different, all three of them, and their parents are very good about knowing who each one is. I think that idea of give them what's best for them, not what's equal, is so, so smart. I want to just talk a little more about shifting our environment. I had on the show Israeli neuroscientist Amir Levine, and he applies what's called attachment theory to relationships. It's usually applied to kids by John Bowlby, the guy who came up with it. It's about that a child, when it's crying, the parent responds. The child feels that there's somebody there who's responsive. And as applied to adults, he feels that it's possible to have a loving partner sort of reparent you if you're insecurely attached, if you're the person who's always pining for connection. And so that would be an example of an environmental correction, having the right partner. And in fact, there's a companion bit of research. I call it a companion bit, but I put them together and thought, wow, how amazing. The dependency paradox. This woman, Brooke Feeney, came up with this finding that if you're in a committed relationship, the more a person feels they can count on you to be responsive when they call for comforting and support, the more independent that person will be. So these sort of like, you know, like clingy people, it actually seems that if their partner responds by being more loving, more attentive, they'll be less clingy.
Well, I think it's a great example of how environments can affect behavior. I'm not familiar with that work, but I can certainly see where having a partner who is responsive to you and loving certainly can bring out the best in you, that's something that is just a very, very basic human need, and so it makes perfect sense. I really think it hits home the point, too, that the genes are not everything. Environment can make a big difference. And we know, for example, that children who are adopted into families that, in fact, most adoptive families tend to be well-off and generally intelligent because they're vetted very carefully. They also tend to be older, secure parents. The children adopted from lower-class families into these upper-class families do tend to do better in cognitive and ability tests than children who are not so moved. And so the environment clearly does have an impact, but it's just the important point is that it doesn't make us all the same. There's still going to be very, very much variation among us. And I think another interesting point is that if you make environments very similar among people, the differences between them are more closely tied to the genes. Now, that may sound kind of paradoxical, but if you think about it, if the environments are all uniform, differences between us has to be due to the genetic differences among us.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I think that is something we don't really think about. I want to get on to Born Together, Reared Apart, and the most amazing twin story that you've discovered, but I should just tell people I'm talking to Dr. Nancy Siegel, developmental psychologist and twins researcher. She's author of Someone Else's Twin, The True Story of Baby Switched at Birth, very compelling book. Born Together, Reared Apart is what we're going to talk about next. And this book, all these books can be found on her website, drnancysiegeltwins.org, and that's S-E-G-A-L. So tell us about the most amazing twin story you've discovered.
Well, let me just point out that Born Together, Reared Apart, the landmark Minnesota twin study, just came out last year, and it's an overview of the methods, origins, findings, controversies, implications of the work I did at the Minnesota Study of Twins Raised Apart, which we talked about earlier in the hour. Now, in addition to the scientific data, I have a lot of very fascinating anecdotes, as you know, and I think they're very, very informative scientific nuggets. And I think the most interesting, amazing one has to do with Jack and Oscar. Jack and Oscar were born in 1933 in Trinidad to a Jewish father from Romania and a German Catholic mother who met on a cruise ship on their way to Trinidad. The marriage soured after 6 months, and so it was decided that Jack would stay with his father in Trinidad and be raised Jewish, and Oscar would go back with his mother to Nazi Germany. And you're not going to get a greater difference in environment than that. Nevertheless, when the twins met at 19 or 20, it was a very cold reunion. Jack had been working in a kibbutz in Israel. He came to Germany. It was a very cold reunion. They didn't get along at all. However, when they were 45, the Minnesota Study of Twins Raised Apart was in progress, and Jack by this time had moved to San Diego. So he wrote to Oscar, because the families had been in touch, at least the mothers had been sending holiday cards. And so Oscar decided, yes, let's give this another chance. So they went to Minnesota, and despite their different rearings, the fact that Jack was raised by a father, Oscar by a mother, totally different political and historical understandings, of course. They were so alike in their love of sneezing loudly in elevators, in their tendency to read books from back to front, their intelligence levels, their personality profiles, almost identical. They both used to wear rubber bands around their wrists, and they used to move. If you were sitting at a restaurant and there was a vase on the table, they'd shove it over. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And so you can say, well, there are no genes for wearing a rubber band around your wrist, and of course not. But there may be genes at some level that cause us to be collectors or have these kinds of personality tendencies. And so the fact that these twins got to the same behaviors, although in different ways, I think is absolutely fascinating. And I think that the take-home message for all of us is that if you think of our little odd quirks and habits, they're not arbitrary. They're there for a reason. They're there because we are the way that we are, and we respond to our environments in certain sorts of ways.
Yeah, I'm thinking about how my sister and I laugh the same. I mean, we really did not spend time together as kids. I had my nose buried in a book. I wasn't interested in her. She was younger. She was a baby. Babies are boring. And just that we laugh exactly the same way years later, I mean, it's so amazing to me.
This is very fascinating. And I think that what also is fascinating is that I find that I'm becoming more and more like my mother as I get older. And see, when they do research on mothers and children, you've got to remember that there's a generational gap. And ideally, you would want to study the child when it gets to be the mother's age, so you don't have the age difference. And I think that many people do find that they kind of grow into their parents in some ways at some level. And you will find yourself doing the things that you sort of were angry about that your mother did to you. But I find what's also fascinating is that you may find that in one generation a child will do something, some quirk or whatever, that you saw two or three generations earlier. People remember it, and yet there was absolutely no contact between these people. And so, again, genes can be passed down through generations silently. In fact, David Licken has this wonderful concept called emergenesis, and this refers to genetically influenced traits that are not passed down in families, which sounds so bizarre. However, what he says is that for complex traits like intelligence, musical ability, artistic ability, you may find one great artist or one great musician suddenly popping up in a family. And it's because this person has genes in certain combinations that he or she got from the mother and father. But when this musician or artist has children of his own, the genes get disentangled, and so you're probably not going to see it after that, or at least not to the same degree. Of course, if they are identical twins, you might see these incredible talents in the two twins. And I actually am quite fascinated by that. I'm a big lover of the Olympics, and I've been watching some identical twins over the years in skiing, in swimming, in gymnastics, in various other kinds of activities, and I marvel at any elite athlete, and I marvel at the fact that you can have two of them at such a great high level.
It's amazing. And actually, I was thinking about something you said about how you see, oh, this expression of this trait in one person, maybe it wasn't there since great-grandpa, and I think now that we have so much videotape, so much photographic equipment just right there in our phones. I mean, I've taken probably 400 pictures of my dog already. I've had her for like a week and a half. That we will be able to see video of our great-grandparents and look at them and see, oh, look, you're doing the exact same thing, not just my little sister and me, but, you know, I mean, not that I have children, but with other people. I think this will be very fascinating in generations to come.
I think it will be. And actually, you know, we see it so much in Mirror to Part Twins, not just in Jack and Oscar, but in a little pair of girls that I watched meet for the first time. You know, I've been studying young Chinese twins raised apart and young Chinese twins raised together, and I'm looking for more subjects. If anyone's out there and have the twins, please let me know. But at any rate, I saw a reunion between 9-year-old identical girls from China who were raised in different families and had never, ever met each other before, and they were so similar, and they got along beautifully for 2 weeks, speaking a different language.
Wow.
And they had a sense of one another. I'm not talking about any kind of ESP because I don't believe in that, but their personalities just meshed so well. They both had this love also of ice water. That's all they ever drank. They had just so many little habits in common. It was remarkable. I mean, it was just you hear about this stuff, but then when you see it right in front of your eyes, it's just so powerful. I know we're in an era right now of molecular genetics where people are searching for genes that go to behaviors, but I have to say that I will never stop being fascinated when I see identical twins who just by doing what comes naturally tell us so much about human behavior right there.
It's so fascinating, and I actually met one of the twins. I don't know if, I think it might have been Oscar, the two men you're talking about raising in Nazi Germany and Trinidad.
You did.
And I remember you talked about how that they had come to the airport and they had the same sunglasses on. I mean, they hadn't planned this, and shirts, similar shirts with epaulets and everything. And it's so amazing that
yes.
I mean, it speaks so much to our genes as
it
drivers
does.
Of behavior.
And you know what? And what it does, Amy, is it tells us, in a way, why we buy the clothes that we do. Because both Jack and Oscar look good in wide-rimmed glasses. They both look good in double-breasted, epauletted shirts. And so, naturally, they're going to buy the same thing. It wasn't a coincidence. Also, they like the same fabrics. You know, certain people get itchy when they wear certain this, or they like certain colors because of their hair or their eye colors. So I think that we can better understand why we choose the clothes that we do. But another point of Oscar and Jack, which I find so fascinating, and this now comes down to the culture that you're raised in, is that both of them knew that if their positions had been switched, if Jack had been raised in Nazi Germany and Oscar had been raised in British-controlled Trinidad as a Jew, they both would have been the kind of person that they loathed the most. They would have adopted and embraced the historical and political understandings that they despised. And that really shows you that you can be embedded in a culture and adopt, you know, the attitudes and beliefs. It's really quite fascinating.
That's so amazing. Now, I mean, is it usually a good experience when these separated at birth twins meet, or is that sort of a
yes.
thing?
It's always been wonderful. And I will say that most twins, but not all, but most have gone on to pursue the relationship and have developed very, very close ties. Identicals more so than fraternals. But the only case where it is not a divorce reunion are the switched birth twins, where that's a separation that was not supposed to happen, and as I said, just really revises everybody's identities and self and sense of self. But in terms of the other reunions, I've seen three or four reunions in person and three or four on tape, and every time I see them, I'm seeing it for the first time, it's just there's a moment of uncontrollable glee at mm-hmm. recognizing someone who looks so much like you. And it's an experience that I can only imagine, but I can sort of taste it vicariously. It's marvelous to see, and you've got to remember that these are people who, for the most part, were adopted all their lives, and so to meet a biological relative and a twin, no less, becomes such an important thing, and you gain in-laws and nieces and nephews that you never knew you had. It's sort of an instant family.
This is so amazing. Now, I forgot to ask you, the guys, the one who was raised in Nazi Germany and the one in Trinidad, did they know or did their parents keep secret from them that they had a brother, you know, who had been torn away from them?
No, it was well known to both of them they had a twin. And, in fact, I've seen some of the letters that they exchanged as children. And it was so endearing. They would say, "Dear Jack, I can't wait to meet you. Love, Oscar." I mean, things like that passed between them. But that was when they were children. And so when they were 20, of course, their take on the political situation was firmed up, and that's when they couldn't get along during that first meeting. But then, of course, at 45, you know, you're willing to put up a little bit more. But I think that that also speaks to the power of identical twinship, because you can't imagine somebody who was Jewish then embracing somebody who, you know, might have held some Nazi views. Although Jack was really, Oscar was not a Nazi. He was pro-German, but he was not a Nazi. But nevertheless, I think it was their fascination with their similarities that really drew them together. So I think the twins put up with an awful lot between each other.
Wow, it's so fascinating. I want to just get into a couple other questions about genes versus environment. Say that your mother's an alcoholic. Does this mean you'll be one too? What's the chance on that?
It does mean that your chances are somewhat higher. It means that you may have inherited some genes that will predispose you towards alcoholism, but it does not mean that you are necessarily going to become an alcoholic. So these are just guidelines. This is information that we can all use. If your mother's a drug abuse person or whatever, it's just that it may be a warning sign to you, but it does not necessarily mean that you're destined to become an alcoholic. Genes are not destiny. That's a very important point for all of us to take home. They're not destiny. They can be modified. Some traits are harder to modify than others. But nevertheless, we're not stuck with our genes, so to speak.
I think that's very important. Genes are a guideline. So if you see that your parent has a drinking problem, understand that maybe you have a propensity to go in that direction. So this is the way, you know, we can be informed by our environment and use it to our benefit.
Exactly, exactly. And then I think that if we talk about virtual twins, we mentioned them before, and let me just briefly define them for everybody. A virtual twin, virtual twins are people who grow up together from birth, but they're not genetically related. So they're kind of environmental twins. You can get them in two ways, if mothers adopt two near in age children at the same time, or they have a biological child and they adopt another one very close in time to the delivery. And they're a marvelous comparison to twins because you've got the same people, you've got people in the same home being raised at the same time, but they share no genes in common. And I can say that in terms of their general intelligence, which I've studied very extensively, there's a little resemblance there, but it's nowhere near identical twins raised apart. So again, that speaks to a particular trait, i.e. general intelligence, being substantially influenced by the genes.
I think you wrote in Born Together, Reared Apart, and I'm talking with Dr. Nancy Siegel, someone else's twin, The True Story of Babies Switched at Birth, that 25% of the individual differences in young children's intelligence are associated with the shared environment, but that drops over time as the kids get older and are less under the influence of their parents. I found that fascinating.
That's exactly right. And one of the studies that one of my colleagues did showed that by the time kids reach adolescence, the correlation between unrelated siblings is about zero. I found that when I went with my kids from 5 till about 11, it dropped considerably. It was about 11% at that point. So really, I think what's happening here is that as you have greater freedom away from your parents to gravitate towards the things in the environment that you like, you are, again, choosing environments that you like that are going to give you the best genetic expression possible, then the differences between you and your sibling are going to be enhanced. They've actually found a similar effect when it comes to sports participation. They found a very modest genetic effect when kids are young and living at home, because then parents tell you to play basketball or go swimming or take ballet lessons. But as you get older, they find a greater genetic effect on sports participation. Not that you're playing sports more. That's not it. We're talking about whether you play or whether you don't play. That's either one is influenced by the genes. So when you're free to really exercise your genetic potentials, then the genetic effect will go up.
Okay, so you're saying if you want to play tennis when your parents are no longer yelling at you to tell you to go to tennis lessons, that's what you're talking about.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay, I was just checking.
Many people think that environmental effects go up over time. And that I can sort of see where they come to that idea because we're exposed to so many more things as we get older. But in actuality, it's genetic effects that tend to go up, and they think it's because certain genes turn on that weren't turned on before, but also because you have greater freedom to organize your environment in ways that you like. So it sounds kind of counterintuitive, but it's true.
It's fascinating. I want to talk about, speaking of fascinating, a study I just heard you present at the Human Behavior and Evolution Society conference. You say that a recurring misconception is that identical twin brothers and identical twin sisters resemble one another in personality because other people treat them alike. And it's argued that the identical twin similar treatment is caused by their identical physical resemblance. But you did this study on personality similarity and unrelated lookalikes. And what did you find?
Yeah. I reasoned that if I could look at personality and unrelated lookalikes, if it was due to environmental treatment by others, they should be as alike as twins. But if they were not alike, then it's probably a genetic effect. And so I found a sample of unrelated lookalikes in a photography studio, Francois Brunel from Montreal. He's been doing this all his life as a habit. He's a photographer, professional photographer. And he allowed me to give personality questionnaires to these unrelated lookalikes. And when I analyzed the data, I found that there was virtually no similarity across 5 different personality traits, extroversion, introversion, openness to experience. So that tells me that identical twins' personality similarity comes not from how people treat them, but rather people's reaction to the similar behaviors that the twins express.
Oh, that's so fascinating.
Yeah.
And
As a parent, if you think that you are causing your child's personality, you may be reinforcing, shaping, this sort of thing, but you're probably not causing. You are reacting to the behavior that the child is expressing.
so fascinating. We're almost out of time. I've been talking with twins researcher Dr. Nancy Siegel. She's the author of Someone Else's Twin, The True Story of Babies Switched at Birth. Born Together, Reared Apart is another one of her books. You can find these books and her other books on her website, drnancysiegeltwins.org, and that's S-E-G-A-L. You can also find the books at Amazon. And so I wanted to just ask you to give us a takeaway message from your research on twins about genes, environment, what we can know that sort of reassuring helps us live our lives better.
Well, I think the take-home message is that genes and environments cause similarities and differences among relatives living together, that we are who we are from a complex mix of genes and environments, that if we get along with one sibling and not with another, it could be partly our genetically based personalities. If we look very different from our family members, this may be partly due to the genes that we have connected to physical similarity. And I think that for parenting, the best thing that we can do is to just pay careful attention to each child's interests, abilities, and talents and try to nurture them. And as a person growing up in this world, try to make the best of your life by finding environments that are congenial for you.
I think that's great advice. Dr. Nancy Siegel, thank you so much. Fascinating always to talk to you, and thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure, Amy.
Universal Studios Hollywood is introducing the California Neighbor Pass. For the neighborly price of just $119 online, you get over 200 days in the park. So swing by and share some laughs with your neighbors, like the Minions or Homer Simpson.
Donuts.
Even go on an adventure with Harry Potter.
Stay close and follow me.
Visit UniversalStudiosHollywood.com to get over 200 days of thrills, laughter, and wonder with the new California Neighbor Pass for $119 online. Pass out for 9 months from selected first visit date. Blackout dates, restrictions apply.
Danny, I just figured out that if I switch to Metro PCS, I get two Samsung Galaxy phones free.
Cool, Dad.
And I could be a super dad with two free Samsung Galaxy phones and call myself Double Galaxy Man.
Or you could give the second phone to your sidekick.
Yeah, I guess I could do that.
That's right. Two free Samsung Galaxy On 5 smartphones are all yours when you switch to Metro PCS. Metro PCS. Wireless. Figured out.
Coverage not available in some areas. Sales tax not included in phone price. Excludes numbers on the T-Mobile network. See store for details and terms and conditions.
Hello.
Hello.
I got two free smartphones when I switched to Metro PCS.
One for him and one for me.
It's not for you. It's for people like me.
And parrots.
I knew I should have gotten a dog.
Get two free Samsung Galaxy J3 Prime smartphones when you switch two lines to Metro PCS and enjoy a 4G LTE network that's more reliable than ever before. Metro PCS. Wireless. Figured out.
Coverage not available in some areas. Sales tax not included in phone price. Excludes numbers on the T-Mobile network are active on Metro PCS in past 90 days. See store for details, terms, and conditions.